Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Philosophy Talk comes to you from Philosophy Corner at Stanford University, where Ken chairs the philosophy department and I work for him.
Philosophy Corner, we're at the studios of KALW, Information Radio in San Francisco. What's this about Philosophy Corner?
Well, we are at KALW, and we're really happy to be there. But we're going to try to create a little virtual Philosophy Corner here at KALW, where people hang out and talk to each other in a philosophical way about everything under the sun.
So what's our topic for the day, John?
Our topic for today is the doctrine, or perhaps Bush's doctrine, of preemptive self-defense.
Oh, preemptive self-defense.
Whatever that is.
Yeah, well, I'm going to give you a little quiz. I'm going to see if you can help me figure that out. First thing, there are wars of aggression. What's a war of aggression?
A war of aggression. Okay, we're out on the streets of Dodge City, and you're the bad guy, and you are shooting at me. That's a war of aggression. I haven't done anything to you.
What's a purely defensive war?
You're shooting at me, and I shoot back at you. That's self-defense. I see you go for your gun, and I go for mine and shoot you.
Right. Aggression is always bad, right? And self-defense is always good.
Well, I don't know if it's always good, but it's okay, I guess.
Yeah. What about preventive wars? There's also something called a preventive war.
Okay. I'm on the streets of Dodge City, and I hear that you're coming in to shoot me, so I drive out to your ranch before you wake up and shoot you. And maybe while I'm at it, I shoot your family because it looks like they're all going to grow up to be mean, too.
Boy, that sounds really bad. What about wars of humanitarian intervention? That's a big thing these days in the 21st century.
Okay, that's like Shane. I'm passing through town. I could go on. You're not bothering me at all, but I notice that you're really mean to the farmers. So no. I shoot you.
Oh, you're a good guy. You shoot me on somebody else's behalf.
Right.
And then there's our topic for the day, wars of preemptive self-defense.
Now, I take it that means that we're on the streets, and instead of, like Matt Dillon, instead of waiting for you to go for your gun, as soon as I'm certain that attack is imminent, I see by the glint in your eye that as soon as you're done wiping your nose, you're going to try to shoot me. I just shoot you.
Wow.
Kind of the way Harrison Ford did in the movie with the guy with the swords, and he didn't wait to be attacked. He just plugged him.
Right, right. Self-defense seems like, that seems good, but it's kind of a patsy's game, right? Wait till the other guy attack, and it's time to, you think you should attack before you get done in. Well, but you said when you're certain. How long does it take to be certain? How certain do you have to be? How soon am I about to attack you? That's the kind of questions we're going to have to deal with, don't you think?
Well, is it an epistemological issue? It's okay to preemptively attack if you're sure? Or is it some kind of ethical thing that, it has to be within a minute of when the attack was going to occur?
Why don't we, our own Amy Standen has a piece about that. We'll hear from her in a few seconds, but we want you to join our discussion. You tell us, how imminent does the likely attack have to be? How certain should the would-be defender be of the upcoming attack? Join us at 415-841-4134.
Our own Amy Standen files this report looking into the background of the Bush doctrine of preemptive self-defense.
If we wait for threats to fully materialize, we will have waited too long. We must take the battle to the enemy, disrupt his plans, and confront the worst threats before they emerge.
That's President Bush at West Point in June 2002, making the case for a new foreign security policy based on preemptive self-defense. In other words, hitting the enemy before the enemy hits you. With the election coming up, you can count on hearing a lot more about preemptive self-defense. A GOP campaign ad, which began airing in Iowa in November, tells us that a vote for Bush is a vote for preemption. Call Congress now, the ad urges. Tell them to support the president's policy of preemptive self-defense. Much has been made about the link between preemptive self-defense and a philosopher named Leo Strauss, who taught Paul Wolfowitz and other Bush advisors at the University of Chicago in the 60s. Strauss was a German émigré who narrowly escaped the Holocaust by fleeing to France and then the United States in the late 30s, and whose writings, the theory goes, described a world in which liberal democracies must actively defend themselves from tyranny. It's a theory that Charles Butterworth, a professor of political philosophy at the University of Maryland, is quick to debunk.
Well, I don't think that there's anything that Strauss said that has any bearing at all on current foreign policy. What has happened is that a number of people who are exceedingly bright Wolfowitz being one, Abraham Shulsky being another, Richard Perle, but a number of people have come through the University of Chicago or have come through another student of Strauss, who's even more important for these kinds of issues, Alan Bloom, and now find themselves in positions of power. But there's nothing nefarious. There's no single line of thought. These are exceedingly intelligent people who have find themselves wielding power in the United States today.
Listening to President Bush on the eve of the attack on Iraq, you can hear the echoes of a philosophy of good and evil, where preemptive strikes are a matter of life and death.
We are now acting because the risks of inaction would be far greater. In 1 year or 5 years, the power of Iraq to inflict harm on all free nations would be multiplied many times over. Terrorists and terrorist states do not reveal these threats with fair notice in formal declarations. And responding to such enemies only after they have struck first is not self-defense. It is suicide.
One report by Congress from December 2002 found that you've got to go all the way back to the Spanish-American War to find a precedent for American preemptive strikes. Of course, taken broadly, preemption can mean almost anything. Regime change in Guatemala, Chile, Iran. You could even argue that the entire Vietnam War was a preemptive strike against a perceived communist threat. The devil, it seems, is in the details. How much evidence does a country need to wage a preemptive strike, and to whom must it make its case? President Bush gave Iraq 1 to 5 years to pose a threat. What about 6 years? 15? Pretty soon you're rewriting the screenplay for Minority Report. Could you justify killing Hitler's mother, his grandmother? How imminent must the threat be? Happily leaving those questions to the professionals, this is Amy Standen for Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Amy. Ken, let's remind ourselves that although it's George Bush and current international relations that set the stage for our question, we're philosophers.
That's right. We're looking
into the philosophical issues, not the politics or even the historical issues. And we're going to have a guest help us do that. Who is our guest?
It's George Lucas.
George Lucas. I mean, what are we going to do? Darth Vader's doctrine of preemptive self-defense?
No, not that George Lucas. This George Lucas is professor of philosophy and associate chair at the Department of Leadership, Ethics, and Law at the U.S. Naval Academy. He will direct a National Endowment for the Humanities Summer Institute this summer called War and Morality, Rethinking the Just War Tradition for the 21st Century. He's taught at Georgetown, Emory, Santa Clara, and we're glad to have him. Welcome to our program, Professor Lucas.
Good afternoon, Ken and John, and thanks for having me aboard.
And Professor Lucas, I say that you, like us, are just a professor. You're not speaking for Bush, the administration, Annapolis,
Absolutely,
the military, or any of those folks.
I'll preempt a headache right off the bat by saying that I am speaking only off the record, unofficially as a private citizen. Nothing I'll have to say, none of the nitwit opinions I'm likely to voice have any connection to the policies of the United States Navy or the Department of Defense.
Okay, that's great. Now, you've listened to Ken and I, who are amateurs, kind of make a hash of your topic. Why don't you tell us now what you conceive of preemptive self-defense? What does that mean, and is it ever right?
And under what conditions would it be right?
Well, that's an interesting and troubling question. You've done a great job of framing it, and while it's a serious subject, it has its humorous moments. I recall in the days leading up to the war in Iraq that there was a terrific political cartoon that had two prisoners sitting in a cell, and one says to the other, "So I discovered that in domestic law, a preemptive strike constitutes felonious assault."
Right.
And the other kind of humorous and also interesting feature of this debate that we've been having in the public about what in the world anticipatory self-defense or preemptive self-defense could mean was that shortly after the president's talk that you aired at the beginning of the show, you saw a lot of very sort of nervous, somewhat stricken military and civilian leaders in Washington who seemed quite surprised and put it politely, the president's out in front of us on this. Can
right.
we do this? We're not sure this is correct.
So and was more the doctrine the military wasn't used to adhering by? Is that what you're saying?
That's right. They thought that wasn't this may not be something that we can do. And to answer the question of whether it was acceptable, they all ran for their copy of our colleague Michael Walzer's book, Just and Unjust Wars.
So philosophers can make a difference.
That's right. Philosophers, be careful what they say. Someone, someone may be listening.
Well, you're training our future military leaders, right, in leadership and ethics and law. So that's
right. And a number of them have in our courses on ethics have taken up this question and written papers on it, and mm-hmm. they've disagreed wildly with one another and with us on whether this is a legal and morally justifiable use of military force or not. And what the conditions would be if it is justifiable, and what this notion of preemption really means.
So why don't you help us? Help us think about when, under what circumstances. I assume you can't just always act preemptively. You have to have some degree of certainty, right?
But
there has to be some degree of imminent.
Even to ask the question, I take it we're assuming we're not in a Hobbesian law of nature. We're, in the 21st century, we've got the United Nations. We have countries with constitutions that bind their decision-making in various ways. So in that context, where does this doctrine fit?
Well, it's a troubling one in the sense that a good place to begin is Walzer and that description of the international community as a kind of, on an analogy with a domestic society of individuals living under the law here in a set of nation-states living under international law. And they have the right to pretty much do as they please as long as they don't hurt each other.
Right.
And they have a right to defend themselves against those entities, those other nations that would hurt them. And in none of that sort of basic conceptual scheme do you find anything like what you're calling the Bush Doctrine, that it would not represent a legitimate use of military force.
Well, I take it in that conceptual scheme, though. Wars of self-defense are okay, right? If somebody attacks
Absolutely.
You,
you're a state
minding your own business, right? If somebody
attacks you. So to go back to your example of the guy with the six-gun waiting to blast you away, are you knowing that he's up to no good? And these are the criteria that Walzer sets out. In fact, knowing that the fellow's up to no good, knowing that he's just about to pull his gun and shoot you, and knowing that just standing around waiting for that will make matters worse in a very literal mm-hmm. sense in that example, you then may, not necessarily do, but you may have a right to defend yourself, not wait until he does the obvious, but actually shoot him before he shoots you. So that's the notion, and the key concept there is imminence. Is there a clear and present danger, a threat that's known to occur?
Now, Professor Lucas, the United Nations was formed, we were already in a nuclear era, where it seems like waiting around for the other guy to attack doesn't make too much sense. Did the United Nations address preemptive self-defense in the Charter?
Before you answer that question, let me remind you that we invite our listeners to join us. You help us decide when preemption is okay. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Professor Lucas, you were about to answer.
Yes. The context of the Cold War was really not a good one in which to imagine preemptive strikes. And in fact, most of the thinking after founding the United Nations was so focused on sovereignty and the rights of self-defense only and the limitation of the resort to force in the superpower rivalry that that the idea that either of the superpowers could worry about what the other one was up to and try and preempt actions on their part would have been largely unthinkable. And so it's that context, it's that conceptual framework that we're operating in. The problem is, and I think there was something about this early on when you both discussed humanitarian intervention and some other issues that have emerged in the last decade, we see a lot more resort to what I would like to call simply non-defensive uses of force.
Okay, we're going to have to take a little break here.
And we'll get back to non-defensive uses of force after the break.
Philosophy Talk continues after this short break. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. The topic is preemptive self-defense. The guest is Professor George Lucas of the Naval Academy. It's time to take your calls. What's our number, Ken?
It's 415-841-4134. And we have Dave from San Francisco on the line.
Hello.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dave.
Hi,
What's
Dave.
Your question?
Hi there. I heard you guys asking, what would be some acceptable criteria for saying that it's okay to preemptively attack. And the point I want to make is that while it may be possible to come up with such such criteria that time may go by and you may find that you were wrong.
Well, that's right. What do you let's ask that to Professor Lucas. What do you think about that, Professor Lucas? That goes to the question of what degree of certainty you need in order to justify.
That's right. That's right. And it's that degree of certainty as well as the imminence question that distinguishes between preemption, which may be in some cases permissible, and prevention, which is this longer term speculation about what other people or other nations might be up to.
Right.
And frankly, allowing prevention, even on otherwise reasonable grounds, as a justification for the use of force sounds like a recipe for continual conflict. We can't really, as this war has shown us, ever be very certain as to what other peoples and governments and non-governmental organizations are up to.
Yeah, so that's a big question. So how do we make
preemption the line
not shade off into preventive war? How do we do that?
Well, the general rule of thumb is that if you're talking about preemption, you're talking about a matter of minutes or hours, perhaps stretching it days, but certainly not, as in Amy Stanton's report, months or years.
Right.
You really have to make some kind of reasonable judgment about what the imminence of the threat will be.
When Israel took out the Saddam Hussein's nuclear plant in the 80s, the U.S., together with the rest of the United Nations, condemned it. Now Powell has said that, in retrospect, it was okay. Did that pass the test of imminence?
I wanted to raise that along with our use of cruise missiles against al-Qaeda targets back in 1998 during the Clinton administration. In Sudan and Afghanistan, that those were all examples of what were called at the time preemption, that all of those facilities were being built or used for no good purpose and represented a threat that that the intelligence community regarded in all cases as clear and present and thus imminent. And yet, imminent wasn't a matter of days, and intention wasn't clear. So all three of those instances, the use of cruise missiles by Clinton, the use of the Israeli Air Force to take out that nuclear reactor, were all condemned by the international community as illegal.
So in terms of language, the pressure is call something that's prevention preemption. Now we've got
that's
a new
right.
caller, Marcia in San Francisco.
Yeah, thanks, David. Marcia, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi there.
What's your question
concept
for us?
For the show? Well, I want to know what you call it when the guy at the end of the street in Dodge definitely has his gun loaded and definitely is thinking about shooting you. So you decide that you're going to take out your gun and shoot the clerk in the dry goods store because you never have liked him.
Wait, it's not the clerk who's threatening you? I don't get the – help me with the example.
I
is it the clerk who's threatening you?
Yeah.
Okay, Professor.
Yeah, the analogy is with Al Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, who represent the threat, and yet we go after the dry cleaner, Saddam Hussein, and his spider hole. And
you call it modern politics. I think
that's right. That's right. Say somehow these two are linked. The dry cleaner's blamed for the six shooter out on the street. So an additional dilemma there. And it's funny how we all resort to these metaphors of the Wild West, in fact, to sort this all out.
That's our cultural
John
heritage.
Westerns,
you know?
That's what we're
well, about. It suggests a situation in which the laws don't cover clearly and unambiguously all the situations that we face and where legal, not only legal conventions, but the mechanisms for enforcing the law, the police and courts and so forth, are not robust enough to give us a sense of protection. So we tend to take the law into our own hands or interpret it or fall back on moral principles on which the law is based. And this seems to be one of those occasions. And the humanitarian interventions are another. We don't have good, clear guidance in the so-called Westphalian paradigm, the notion of the modern nation state with its integrity and sovereignty and so forth, when we can intervene.
Thanks for the call, Marcia.
Janet's on the line. Janet from Berkeley. How are you doing, Janet?
Hi. I'm wondering whether a question before this matter would be, what is our self-interest? What constitutes our self-interest? And is it in our self-interest to kill 5,000 to protect 1,000, et cetera?
Well, there is a question of, I guess, there's always a question with these doctrines of proportionality, right?
The response must
be proportional to the threat.
That's one place where our metaphor of the Old West isn't very good because, you know, with an individual, it's maybe not totally clear philosophically what self-interest is, but it's pretty clear. With a nation, It's not so clear at all. Whatever we're doing something for to the men who die and the women who die and their families, it didn't seem to be in their self-interest. So it's a, I think, a very legitimate point you're making.
Okay, certainly well, is, especially.
I think it's a great dialogue. I wish that we had a nationwide dialogue to decide what we, as a nation, believe is our mm-hmm. best.
Well, when
interest.
We get philosophy talk across the nation, we'll make that dialogue happen. Okay. Thanks for your call,
Thank
Janet.
You. Bye-bye.
Professor Lucas, do you think that there's a premise in the current worldview that it's in the United States' interest to really control a lot of the world?
Well, one of the interesting things about this discussion, and it has been a very good public philosophical discussion over the last several months, both in this country and abroad, is the relative absence of references or appeals to self-interest. Self-interest, national self-interests, are not altogether clear. In fact, the appeals tend to be more to the needs and the welfare of civilized nations and peoples,
right.
for lack of a
right.
better phrase, versus those infrequently characterized as criminal elements that would undermine the rule of law and the security and stability that it provides the rest of the world.
I think that's an important point. I mean, because one of the things – you started out talking about this array of nation states living under, well, something like international law, but that's a fairly weak thing, and the conventions governing it aren't that explicit. But it seems as though we're kind of – moving toward an order in which there's greater respect for, you know, as it were, the sense of the international community. Except, on a political note, Bush did act outside the UN, but we don't want to get into politics here.
That's well, right. but still, there's, I mean, we've got at least three different things here. We've got preemptive self-defense, which, at least if it's not unilateral, maybe is, in some sense, kosher in the United Nations.
At least sometimes.
Then we've got preventive war, which people are going to call preemption, as Professor Lucas points out. And we've got humanitarian, the Shane example. And maybe one of them or two of them or all three of them are defensible, but you don't want to have a bait and switch type of thing. And I think that's what a lot of people are worried about in the present situation.
Why don't we hear from another caller? We have Judith from Mountain View on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Judith.
Thank you. Going back to the Wild West analogy, instead of riding out to the ranch and shooting them, what about riding out to the ranch and talking to them?
Yeah, so you're wondering what the alternatives. A justification of acting preemptively has to exhaust the alternatives to war.
Why does it always have to be force?
Yeah. Well, can you help us with that, Professor Lucas?
Well, yeah, so I think the dilemma would be if you're aiming at prevention and it's not really imminent and it's not really preemption, then there's always this choice. Why not do something other than force?
Well, one of the criticisms of the recent U.S. policy and actions were not merely that they tended to look pretty unilateral to the rest of the world, notwithstanding our coalition of the willing, but also that there was a ready resort to force as opposed to persuasion or diplomacy or economic sanctions or even the threat of force restraining the actual use or appeal to it. So the caller's question is a very good one. Are we too prone to pull the trigger when we're in situations that are delicate and uncertain like this? Did we give diplomacy? Did we give the UN weapons inspectors and indeed our own forces arrayed on the borders of Iraq time enough to be there to force compliance with reasonable behavior on the part of the government before acting to appeal to force itself?
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Professor George Lucas from the U.S. Naval Academy. We're talking about Bush's doctrine of preemptive self-defense. We have a caller on the line, Paul in Albany. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paul.
Good afternoon. I know you don't really want to talk about too much politics or whatever, but my really serious question is, why?
But you're going to make us, huh?
Why are we not learning lessons? Okay, so a classic lesson is, I actually watched CBS 60 Minutes 2 days before 9/11, and I watched Henry Kissinger justify what we did in Chile, right?
Okay.
Now, the point is, we are doing exactly the same thing today in Venezuela. All of these new labor unions, middle class movement, whatever, they are activated and generated by the CIA in the same way as it was done in Chile.
Well, that's a very interesting point, but I'm not sure it's square on our doctrine of preemptive self-defense. It sounds like an example of prevention And it sounds like if you're right, it's clearly not very justified either from a practical or a moral point of view. Let's go on to, thanks for the call. Let's go on to Julian in San Francisco.
Hello. My question is this. What would Gandhi think of the doctrine of preemptive strikes? And if Gandhi's philosophy is incompatible with that doctrine, which doctrine is correct?
That's a good question. I mean, you could always say that. I said at the beginning of the show, I think, I said that self-defense is always permissible, is always good. So that if somebody aggresses against you, you can always defend yourself by violent action. But you might think, well, why not appease the aggressor? Why not? Or why not use some non-violent forms of resistance? So it might not be that even just self-defense rather than preemptive self-defense is always good. What do you think about that, Professor Lucas?
Well, certainly, I think Gandhi would take a dim view of the current U.S. position on the use of force preemptively or preventatively.
Thanks for the question, Paul.
Yeah. The interesting thing, I think, is that Gandhi himself, the question of whether one can deal in international relations in a doctrine of in a manner that's proposed by this doctrine of Satyagraha. Nonviolent self-defense is really, really efficacious. And, of course, the philosopher Martin Buber rejoined it to Gandhi back in those days that if you lived in Germany, you might have a different view than the one you form dealing with the British in India. But that's a troubling question. And
I have a question of my own. I'm still a little puzzled. I don't feel as though we've gotten clear. I'm still worried about when this doctrine of preemptive... We say aggression's always bad, right? We say preventive wars are less justifiable.
Pretty dubious.
Yeah. When does this doctrine of preemptive... I see a danger that preemptive self-defense could shade off into either mere aggression or a preventive war. And how are we supposed to make that dividing line? It seems to me a delicate question that I'd like some guidance on from you.
Well, we just haven't done a very good job of that as of yet. All we really have are Michael Walser's criteria, which were... in that context, an attempt to understand when, if ever, there would be exceptions to the rule in this international or what he called the legalist paradigm or the Westphalian paradigm of the nation-state system. He recognized even 25 years ago that there were certain situations that at least called for some philosophical reflection, moral reflection to determine when exceptions might be granted. And we need to be doing that sort of thing now, certainly with regard to this doctrine. It's not as new as it seems. We see that while it hasn't been enunciated as such, that certainly previous administrations have followed it. There was regime change in Panama when the United States interdicted Manuel Noriega, who's still in jail in Miami, as I understand it, for drug charges. And certainly our intervention in Kosovo for humanitarian reasons was deemed illegal and was condemned.
Yeah. Let me tell our listeners that we have a web page, which is www.philosophytalk.org. And on that web page, if not now, within a couple of days, there will be references to Michael Walser's works and other people that we've mentioned.
Professor George Lucas's work?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. We have callers on the line. There's Leif in Berkeley. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Leif.
Thanks for talking with me. I was concerned about that the question of preemptiveness manifests the necessity to consider it. That is, if you're in Dodge and you've got, I put a different analogy, you have all these people here, everyone's carrying weapons.
Yeah.
And so are you.
Right.
So I don't understand how the president, let alone Americans, debate that we're in Dodge and we don't have a gun, and we're looking for everyone else who might have a gun. And the fact that we ask the question with our own weapons is total hypocrisy, because as soon as if we were to ask that question, how can we protect ourselves against someone else, well, then we would arm ourselves to do that, and then it puts that question on other people's shoes. Just is the same question that has been going on since they dropped the before we dropped the atomic bomb.
I'm not quite sure I understand, but let me try. So if you had a sort of Hobbesian view, the given state of all people relative to one another is constant war. And maybe there isn't war at the moment, but it's going to break out any second. And the only question is when and who. And there's not really any moral question. And so we're in Dodge. Everybody's got a gun. Why should we worry about when we use our gun? Since you know somebody's going to use it. Is that the kind of worry that you have? And am I getting you right, Leif?
No, I think the question that you're asking is whether we should preempt, whether it should be considered, the Bush asked, or is proposing that we should. Consider preemption or use it, which we just did. It manifests the need to consider the problem because we create a world, in which we just did, where everyone's asking how do they protect themselves against us.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So there's something a little bit self-defeating about American foreign policy, one might argue, that it creates a world in which everybody's so scared of us that we have to be scared of them. What do you think of that, Professor Lucas?
That's a real concern. I think it takes us back almost to Thucydides and the Peloponnesian Wars and the behavior of Athens back then. We're in that same situation now, the sole remaining superpower. And however good we may think our intentions are, we have to be careful that suspicion and mistrust on the part of even allies and friends, as well as neutral states or enemies, might grow to the point, given our unilateral authority and power, that we be seen as the enemy. This has actually been al-Qaeda's argument against us.
Right.
And while I don't buy it for a minute in terms of their actions, I think that we need to beware of behaving with a kind of unilateral arrogance that would alienate our best friends and our necessary allies.
Coming up after the break, our 60-second philosopher. Thank you for joining us at Philosophy Talk.
It's time now for a regular Philosophy Talk feature, the 60-Second Philosopher. The 60-Second Philosopher is Ian Scholes, who has a high-bandwidth discussion of important philosophers that he shares with us on each episode of Philosophy Talk. This time, he's going to tell us about Machiavelli, one of the greatest and most important of political philosophers, and it's going to take him approximately 1 minute. Ready, set, go.
Ian Scholes. In 1498, Niccolo Machiavelli was a career diplomat for the city-state of Florence. When the Republic collapsed 10 years later, he was forced into a life of retirement and scholarship. Machiavelli's slim book, The Prince, was written in 1533. It was intended, apparently, as an instruction manual to teach some wannabe despot how to reunite Italy, a prospect dear to Machiavelli's heart. It was also intended to be his resume/calling card for the Medicis, the cutthroats running things at the time. But The Prince was not published in his lifetime, so his would-be employers and despots never read it. And Italy wasn't unified until a few hundred years after his death, so the book was a failure. Yet the book has resonance today. Some cite The Prince as the root of any evil committed by any statesman anywhere, while others call it the one book fuzzy-thinking tree-huggers should read so they can grasp what the cruel world is really like. The most disconcerting thing about The Prince is its dispassionate tone. It treats kindness and cruelty as equivalent activities, both mere tools in a prince's belt. At one point, Machiavelli tells us that if you must crush an enemy, destroy his family as well, otherwise his vengeful offspring will grow up to get you. Machiavelli himself was a Christian, a believer, but The Prince is not a Christian tome. If you're going to be a prince, you must do whatever it takes to secure your princely area. Surrounded by treachery and ambition, a virtuous man cannot survive as a prince. Is the book dangerous? No. The Prince is just a self-help manual for dictators. That's a narrow demographic, and they tend to spend their disposable income on palaces and statues of themselves, not books. As for the rest of us, people always blame books for the ills of the world, along with comics, rap music, and video games. But we should always remember, books don't kill people. People kill people. People with grudges, ideologies, ambitions, and, of course, loaded weapons. I gotta go.
So, Ken, Machiavelli's an interesting guy, but why Machiavelli this week? Are we trying to say something about our beloved president?
Well, I mean, think of it this way. One of the things, Bush sold the war as a... on a basis of this doctrine of preemptive self-defense. It's not clear it really was that. I mean, so what was Bush doing? Was he giving us a Machiavellian defense of a policy that, you know, he couldn't really justify? But I mean, his real reason might have been it's a war of intervention, humanitarian intervention. It's a war. It's a preventive war. But he couldn't sell that. So I don't know. Why don't we ask the question of what kind of war was this war really?
Well, we remind you, you're listening to Philosophy Talk, not Politics Talk. We won't try to judge our leaders, but give you the concepts that you can use to discuss them.
Yeah, but we want to talk about this particular case and what kind of war this really was.
Our guest is the philosophy professor, George Lucas, from the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And we have a few more minutes to talk to him.
Yeah, so to help us think about what kind of war the War of Iraq really is. Is it preventive self-defense, a preventive war, a war of naked aggression, a humanitarian intervention? What kind of war is it really?
Well, it's certainly not a war of naked aggression. And in fact, somebody could argue that it would have been in our best interest to just leave this alone, our best national interest to just let this be. We did have troops, of course, stationed in Saudi Arabia. That was one of the complaints that al-Qaeda lodged against us.
Yeah.
Why were they there? They were there because Saddam was in Iraq. We had many of our men and women flying missions over the no-fly zone, protecting Kurds and Shiites and so forth from Saddam. Why were they there? Because he was still in power. He's not there anymore, and
right.
All those folks have gone home. Of course, we've inherited, as often as the case, a new set of problems. So why is this war fought? Is it fought for reasons of aggression? Certainly not. For better stability in the region, that's the hope, but those things are hard to engineer. One of our earlier callers asked the question, why didn't we use the force of persuasion and reason as opposed to military might to
settle
the issue?
Saddam Hussein is the answer to
yeah.
that.
Well, Saddam Hussein's the answer to that. And you might ask, well, in that analogy with the West, why don't you call the police? And there's our problem. We don't have a constabulary at the international level.
Right.
And that's clearly what was called for here. And in a number of these other instances, one that would be able to intervene and be relatively impartial about it in its own actions to prevent violence or to enforce the rule of law. We don't have anything like that in the current international order, and that's the glaring deficiency.
So it sounds like you think that if there was the rationale under which it might be best to think about this war, independently of what Bush and the Bush administration gave, might be this umbrella of humanitarian intervention. And we might think about, effective and moral ways to engage in such things. Is that the right way to think
about
it?
Yes, I think that's exactly right, that these are both similar kinds of activities, that there's a lot of, generic resemblance in a humanitarian war of humanitarian intervention and a war of counter-terrorist preemption, that both are done as much as anything on behalf of the civilized order and the rule of law and people minding their own business and pursuing their own lives and wanting to have protection against criminal elements that threaten that.
Right.
We don't have any way of dealing with
it. We might have to have you back for another show on that topic because it's a fraught topic, right? Because if you're going to intervene in a humanitarian way, on whose side should you intervene? The Kurds, the Shias?
Would it be fair to say that, going back to something you said earlier, that the United Nations Charter, which is the most global thing that we have, I guess, in terms of a system of would-be laws, was formed during the Cold War, and we really need to kind of readdress some of these questions in the current context.
When philosophers know that when you encounter exception after exception or problem after problem or mm-hmm. what we'd call anomaly after anomaly with a given conceptual structure or framework that we've developed, that you may not be able to fix this. It may call for a new sort of fundamental thinking. And we seem to be in a situation like that in terms of international law, international relations, since the end of the Cold War, that it's revealed that we have always subordinated the needs of individual human rights to the sort of price of peace that we bought in 1648 in the Peace of Westphalia by allowing nations
what a
the
learned
right to do
fellow
what they
you
please
are.
in their own borders.
Now,
and,
that's
one a high thing price to pay.
One thing that's fairly certain is the upcoming political campaign is not going to put a premium on philosophical clarity. I think we'll see the word preemption given meanings it's never had. It'll be confused with humanitarian intervention and prevention.
Yeah.
We hope one small thing Philosophy Talk can do is to help equip some of our listeners to enter these discussions with distinctions in mind and maybe even some good, pithy Wild West metaphors to help pin them down.
Why don't we hear from one of those listeners? Charles
Let's
in Redwood
that.
City is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charles.
Hello, gentlemen. Very interesting show.
Thanks.
I was curious about something your last caller mentioned, the role he brought up to me was the role of fear and intimidation in the qualification of this notion of imminence and preemption. Like, how soon are you going to get hit by this? And is that how you justify when to pull the trigger first? I'd like to compare that this sort of war between nation states in that regard. We'll skip the Al Qaeda part right now, but focusing on Iraq. With another police kind of action, let's go back to the story of the shooting of Amadou Diallo
in
New York.
Mm-hmm.
Here you do have a police agency in place, much like we had containment of Iraq in place. But it seems that, like in that situation, there was an element of fear, at least on the part of the police officers, the policing agency, with regard to their suspect, that you know, conditioned their response in a way that was essentially wrong.
Yeah.
He was unarmed, and they used overwhelming force, a little shock and awe.
Yeah.
And it seemed that the result of that, those people getting off with that, seems very much analogous to what's going on here with our war with Iraq.
Yeah. Thank you. That's
partly the fear brought on is the country, our country is prepared to be afraid, but our action is shock and awe to intimidate the other party.
Yeah, thank you, Charles. That's a good question, Professor Lucas. I mean, this goes back to our question. You know, if you fear the other guy may attack you, you may fear that without knowing, right? I mean, do you have to know or merely, you know, fear that the other guy's
going to
attack?
It's also a good reason not to leave the decision up to the attackee or the potential attackee, the one who's likely to be fearful, to bring some other parties in that might have a little more objective sense of what's imminent and what's not.
Right. You'd like to superimpose some kind of, regulatory body. The police, in this case, or in this caller's example, are a problem because they themselves are human beings and afraid of being attacked.
Mm-hmm.
There's another example like this that kind of helps us understand the dilemmas of anticipatory self-defense, and it's a domestic one. It's the Waco incident, the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, that we knew that there were possibly illegal actions going on inside there, that there might be threats to public safety and security. There might even be, harm going on to some of the people who were part of the compound, yet we didn't know that for a fact. We intervened militarily, if you will, and we're still second-guessing that decision today. It's a mess, and we wonder, were we right to do it? Were we justified? We being the FBI in that case. And I think that the jury's still out on Iraq, as well as on the larger question of whether this sort of non-defensive use of force is wise, prudent, or even feasible. And I think we'll continue to participate in a very important national dialogue about that in the months to come.
Yeah, I don't know. Have we solved anything, gentlemen? Have we only raised a bunch more questions?
Philosophers don't solve things, except
we leave it to the politicians to solve things.
No, we don't do that either. But we do try to develop some concepts that are helpful to people in thinking and discussing things. And I think Professor Lucas, you've been enormously helpful to us in that today.
Yeah,
and
thank you a great deal for joining us. It's been a stimulating
discussion.
Thank you
both. It was really great to be with you.
So Ken, what do we leave you with in terms of the doctrine of preemptive self-defense? You think it's a valid, justified doctrine if the threat is imminent?
Yeah, I think it can be. I'm still puzzled about, how to prevent it from shading off into naked aggression on the one hand, or this preventive war thing, on the other. I think it's a very much a work. If it's justifiable at all, it's very much a work in progress, and our institutions haven't yet spelled out a real rationale and limits of this policy.
Yeah, on a purely philosophical basis, I would be more like Harrison Ford and less like Matt Dillon. when you get to a practical matter, the question is just what the last caller said. If the person who's worried about being attacking is the one who has to make the decision, there's just a conflict of interest.
Yeah, you want to make sure you're not acting out of mere fear.
Now, maybe in this case, as George Bush and our colleague Condi Rice thought, the United Nations just wasn't up to it, or maybe they were. But it certainly would be good to have these decisions about preemptive defense not made unilaterally by the preemptor.
Now we're about to turn to something different, where instead of us setting a topic, you, our caller, set the topic. It's a little thing we call conundrums.
Is that the Stanford Band?
No. That's not drumming. John, that's conundrumming.
Conundrumming. Okay. Today's conundrum comes from Peter Joyce of Portland, Oregon. He joins us now on Philosophy Talk. Hello, Peter.
Welcome to
gentlemen.
Philosophy Talk. Tell us about your conundrum.
Well, my conundrum has to do with time. I heard it on a comedy radio show in the early 60s in Cleveland, Ohio.
Wow, that's going way back.
It's been on the back burner of my mind. I have no answer, and I can't explain it.
Well, here it is. We're your guys.
Okay. To measure time, we use motion. For example, one day is once around the sun. The swinging pendulum of a clock measures the passage of time. But to measure motion, we use time. For example, miles per hour, light years. So my question is, can time really be measured? There seems to be two kinds of time. One is the time we all agree to. This is the clock and calendar time. We all agree that a day will be divided into 24 hours. And the other kind of time is the individual time we all experience, in which this moment now can seem like an eternity, or a time when a whole evening seems like a moment gone in a flash.
When you're with your favorite girl or something.
That's an interesting conundrum, and while Ken figures it out.
Oh, wait a minute. No, you're the time expert here, John.
Time's a problem.
John's a big time guy.
St. Augustine, one of my favorite philosophers, said, time is kind of hard to understand because you take any interval, say a minute, and you can divide it into the part that's already occurred and the part that hasn't occurred. And what's left is the present. But nothing's left.
Right, because the present has what? How wide is the present?
However wide it is, take the past part away and the future part away, and you're left with the real present, and it's not there, the specious present. And yet, in a way, that's all that's real.
Does the past exist?
I don't know.
That's a different question. Yeah. Okay, but
does the future exist?
So let's think about it. It seems to me the answer to your conundrum, insofar as there is an answer, must be that the whole process makes sense if we make some big assumption that we must be implicitly making.
What's that?
So what is that big assumption?
I don't know. I'm not following you here.
Well, I mean, we really have not just two definitions, the definition or two ways of measuring, but we also have what's measured. We have stuff in the world that we apply them to.
Right.
So and that must be how we get out of the circularity.
So help me. Yeah.
Does time move, or do we stand still and let time go by?
That's a good question, too. That's different from your first question.
But
you were wondering about being trapped in a circle.
We do seem to need
time
to,
in terms of space,
to assume
space
that
of
there
time.
Are orderly. We have to assume that time is measurable,
and
we have to assume that there are orderly processes.
I understand. Einstein says time cannot be measured. That's one of his.
Well,
we don't have much time to solve this, John. We got 30 seconds. give him the 30-second answer.
Okay, the 30-second answer is that if we assume that time is measurable and that we've got some processes that are regular in time, then in your system of definitions, we're really using those processes to measure other processes. So time, in a way, doesn't get measured. We get just the relative times between the striking of the clock, the turnings of the earth, and so forth and so on. There's a lot deeper answers to this. Yeah. Go to your local community college and take a course in the philosophy of science. Thanks a lot for your conundrum.
You.
It was a great one.
Yeah, and if you want to submit a conundrum, log on to our website at philosophytalk.org and send us an email at philosophytalk.perry@stanford.edu, and we'll consider your conundrum.
So, also, there's our webpage. You can mail directly from the webpage. We'll have some information on the webpage about this show, about the former show. It's time for us to say goodbye. Are we going to do that fancy kind of funny stuff they do on Car Talk?
That's too derivative.
Okay.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
That's
copyright 2004.
That's Leland Stanford Junior University, Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Our production team includes Peter Crimmins, Amy Standen, Monica Blakely, Alex Martinez, Jim Swenson, Merle Kessler, Matt Bauer, and Alan Acosta.
Gosh, it takes us all those people to make this work. Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Hedy Jakovowicz.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institute, the Greenwald Foundation, the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And that's not all. Also from the Provost Office at Stanford University, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, Stanford's Office of Public Affairs, the Stanford Humanities Centers, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KLW, Information Radio, San Francisco, where our programming originates.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our funders or anybody in their right mind.
For more information, visit philosophytalk.org.
Thanks for listening. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.